is the Freedom Fiends, broadcasting from Pod Bay 2A a mile above sea level at Intergalactic Prairie Studios. We alter your locus coeruleus by warming your synapses with rejuvenative radio waves. This warms your brain to a tasty and toasty 365 degrees Fahrenheit to keep a sin flood of statism out of your head. Can you feel it? Is it working? Hugo? Randy? Can you feel it?
Sure, I can
Hi,
feel
Angela.
It.
Hi, Angela. Yes.
I can feel
it. Oh, and I'm so glad to be here. Yes. I can feel it.
Oh.
Yes.
This Freedom Fiends is covered by a BitCot no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BitCot.org.
That's a license.
That is my favorite license. And don't pass over it lightly, because the penalties, the remedies for violating the license are substantial. You can read about it at BIPCOT.org, as you said, Angela.
You can be seriously shamed.
Yes. Well, you guys, where you are, it's probably very warm. And where I am here in Jefferson City, Missouri, we're kind of like right in the middle of the state. And we've one of those places that have had all the horrible flooding over the last couple of weeks and that. Although here in the Ozarks, for ages, we've been building our roads and our houses on the tops of the ridges. But there are some river dwellers downstream that haven't figured that out, and they're getting flooded, and I feel sorry for them, but they should maybe take a cue from folks here in the Ozarks and build your house and your road on the top of the ridges and not in the valleys. But I think we're going to be cold. We're getting colder out, and the snow's going to be coming tomorrow, but that's not going to happen to you, is it, Hugo?
Not at all. It's, as far as I know, it's never snowed in Mexico City, though some people say it happened a couple of hundred years ago. But no, even in the middle of January, it's still pretty comfortable. You know, light jacket and maybe a scarf if it's too chilly outside. But normal tropical weather for the Valley of Mexico, and pretty comfortable. Maybe it's the fact that it's 20 million people around here in the city that we generate a substantial amount of heat. Maybe that's the thing.
That would be amazing amount of heat, depending on how close together you are. How close are you to the person that's next to you right now?
Right now, not really close. But imagine going in the subway with I don't know, a couple hundred people. It gets pretty warm.
20 million people.
Yeah. Not at the same
not
time,
all at
but
once.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
Yes.
Sure. And Angela, how's California?
It is. We've just gotten through a cold snap. It's 49 degrees here. It's a little warmer than it had been.
Hmm.
It's and famous you say for a cold snap. Is that for someone who's... it gets cold in the mountains there, right? Really cold?
In the city, we had 40 degree, three or four days of 40 degree temperatures.
And this is by the ocean, right?
I'm about 20 minutes in from the ocean.
Well, I mean, that's compared to me, that's by the ocean. You could practically dip your toe in it from your front porch. Pretty cold.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, in something.
Yeah, it's pretty cold. I'm doing the conversion. I have to do the conversion because I only know Celsius. And yeah, it's pretty chilly. Yeah. No, you know, I don't know what it would be if I moved to New Hampshire, which is supposedly it's very cold, right?
If you did move to New Hampshire, you would definitely have to get a little more familiar with the Fahrenheit scale, because that's the way the temperature is reported there, I understand. And I was up there this last year, and I think I remember them using that particular scale. In fact, New Hampshire got an email a while back from the Free State Project in New Hampshire, and they were asking for, I'm not sure if they were asking for money to help get the word out or if they were asking me to sign up, but they were saying, hey, we're getting close to meeting our goal. And the Free State Project, for anyone that's not familiar of it, there's an effort in New Hampshire to get as many freedom-loving people, libertarians, voluntarists, anarchists, I don't know, not the bomb-throwing kind, but freedom-loving people to move to New Hampshire. And if you get enough people there, perhaps they can really influence the state and make it a much freer place. And if you agree to go to New Hampshire, you don't have to go right away. They just ask you to sign a pledge that where you say, I solemnly intend to move to New Hampshire. This is their pledge. Within 5 years of the Free State Project reaching 20,000 participants. Once there, I will exert the fullest practical effort toward the creation of a society in which the maximum role of government is the protection of individuals' rights to life, liberty, and property. And if you join the Free State Project, you sign that pledge, you agree to move there. As soon as they get 20,000 pledges, well, not as soon as they do, but within 5 years of reaching the 20,000. And the kicker, the important thing is that they're getting very close to it. And who knows, by now I'm sure they have more than what they had when they sent the email, and it was 93% of their goal. And that apparently there had been earlier years where it was moving very slowly, but in the past year or so I think it has just taken off, and they're really, really expecting to meet the goal this year, I think. And you know, that's kind of interesting, exciting for them. For personal reasons, I can't see that I'm ever going to be there, but it's an interesting idea. And it was interesting to you, right, Hugo?
It was, and I think it was 2011 or 2010 when I saw it first. I was already an anarcho-capitalist or libertarian, however you want to call me, and I found that there was that project, there was a project to move liberty people together, and I actually did sign the pledge, and well, I'm waiting for that. I'm not sure if it's already happened. I'm pretty sure I'd have gotten an email on my inbox by now if it did happen.
Did you sign?
I did.
5 years ago?
Yeah, sure. Ah. Yeah, a long time ago. I had been, well, first time I went to Porkfest, which is a festival that happens in New Hampshire in the summer, the Porcupine Freedom Festival. The first time I went there, I had already been assigning for 2 years. So, yeah, I was very, and I am very interested in that. But it has, you know, I really like that they put in the word maximum role of government. If they had not put that word into the pledge, I would probably have never signed. Because it doesn't, it sounds like you have to support government if you don't say the maximum role of government. You know, it could be zero.
Well, and even saying the maximum role of government is more than many people in New Hampshire and more many people that are moving there would even concede to the government. But that makes it a much bigger tent, so that you couldn't want to even belong to the Free State Project unless you wanted a very, very tiny role for the government. Because if all they did was protect you and your property, then you would still have to ask the question, you know, who will build the roads?
Yeah,
and those sorts of things, which is still pretty hardcore libertarian, I guess. So it's not going to interest you if you're still, you know, wanting to keep up the empire and protect U.S. interests overseas.
Yeah, and the issue of borders,
and all the things,
is a very interesting one recently, and I guess they will have to, you know, discuss that at some point. Though I understand the project is not about what they're going to do next, but just bringing them in, right?
I just assume that once they get, you know, enough people there, they're figuring that they can is take over a good word? I'm not sure. Look out for the libertarians. What they want to do is they want to take over and then leave you alone. Maybe that's, you know, what they do want to do. But the people that are already there in New Hampshire are certainly not waiting for the other 20,000 to show up. I mean, it's a very, very active place. And like you said, you've been to the Porcupine Freedom Festival, and I was there this last year, and I know Angela was there this last year, and maybe she's there every year. I'm not sure, Angela. But they're very, very, very active. There's a lot going on in Liberty in New Hampshire. It's
Angela, are you a signer of the FSP, Angela?
I'm a committed urban dweller, I'll say that, but I make regular appearances like an apparition of the Virgin Mary in New Hampshire, often at Porkfest.
They say there's cities in New Hampshire.
They say that. There's a little bit of deception. There's a little bit of lying about the fact that it is quite cold there, and that they say the solution is sweaters. Made a lot of discussion about layering of clothing is a big discussion.
Those aren't even big in Mexico City, are they? You
know? Well, yeah, we can have light sweaters. There's no problem with that. But I don't think you can go through a blizzard in a sweater. So
no,
yeah.
But the Free State Project is the single most successful libertarian non-electoral project. By far, and has been for a long time, even though it seems recently the numbers have been growing very quickly now. It has actually been doing fairly well for several years, and it came at the right time. I remember hearing the very first, well, not very first presentation, but it was 2004 at the Libertarian Party convention in Atlanta, and it was a suit and tie presentation with political science, figures, and facts.
Yeah, but it's been changing, right? We'll be talking about that when we come back from the market.
When we come back.
Worms.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
Hey, this is Nathan Explosion from Death Clock, and you're listening to Freedom Fiends on the radio. Worms.
Meow. Meow, meow, meow.
Freedom Fiends, and we're back. We're back, and now we're
back.
Talking. Yeah, we're back. We're talking
from
about
the market.
From the free market of products that will probably interest you. And we were talking about the FSP, which is a Free State Project, which is a project to bring 20,000 liberty-minded people to New Hampshire. I'm saying bringing, like I'm in New Hampshire, right? It's probably I've listened to that phrase a lot of times from Ian Freeman and his show. But Angela was talking before about one time in 2004, probably, right, where you were hearing the first thing about.
Yes, yes, there was a presentation that was done as a breakout session at the Libertarian National Committee's convention. This is in 2004, and just to give you some context, we're a couple years already into the wars, and this was really changing and causing a lot of controversy into the Libertarian Party, where there had been some fragmenting into people who had supported the wars, as well as efforts to bring in more what people felt was more continuing war appeals to conservatives, which was skewing a little bit the electoral and the political priorities of the Libertarian Party. So there were some difficulties, and the party just had, at that time, while it was important, it was probably never as important as the days when, David Koch was the vice presidential candidate, and people like Murray Rothbard served on the Libertarian National Committee kind of moment. I mean, the party was never going to be that legendary again, but still was really important. And a lot of people in the grassroots, people who don't come through think tanks, who didn't come through the Institute for Humane Studies, and a lot of the different more conventional think tank culture groups in the movement, Libertarian Party was the place you started. That's where you got your training activism. So The party, though, really, at that time, it was going through some growing pains because of the wars. And the Free State Project, which was, I believe, Jason Sorens, a political scientist who'd kind of come up to study, and I think people voted on these cities that would meet all the criteria for what it would take to create the kind of the numbers to change elections and change laws. And I went to their presentation. I grew up in the libertarian movement, so I'm kind of used to weird, kooky kind of things all the time. My family was a little bit counterculture in sort of a rightish sort of way. And I didn't have any intention of really, you know, doing much with it. I just wanted to hear the presentation, and it was extremely impressive. And one of the women running it was a woman named Amanda, who was a kind of a Renaissance woman, like educated in several different ways, and a pilot and an adventuress, and just kind of really other people they were just really impressive, and they were people of stature, you know, people who exuded a certain amount of leadership in their own lives. And it was just a very impressive project, and through the years, it's been a very successful one. They've gotten all kinds of different kinds of press coverage. They've shown a diversity of libertarian approaches to activism works, as well as appealing to a diversity of kinds of libertarians. I mean, it's a coalition group. Many different kinds of libertarians are in the Free State Project and in New Hampshire, and they've been running successful events. And what was considered a little bit kooky, or people, you know, Reason Magazine was covering it, but was considered a little bit outre and kooky, and then the Libertarian Party felt a little threatened by it. But as it turned out, you know, all these years later, now you have all these very mainstream groups showing up with big booths, including even the objective, whichever David Kelly's objectivist group is. These very, you know, more conventional parts of think tank culture now go to Porkfest every year, and big speakers go to Liberty Forum. So people go to the Free State Project. People want to be seen there. People want to be associated with it. So it's been huge. Hugely sick. I mean, it's the only thing that's comparable to it, but it's, of course, attached to electoral politics would be the Ron Paul 08. But no, it's the Free State Project deserves all the success it has, and it's, even if it did nothing more than this, you have an amazing opportunities for people to live their values. So I don't have enough good things to say about. I mean, there's too many things I could say that are good about the Free State Project and why it's important for the libertarian movement. The grassroots are what matters. I mean, the ideas are what need to be acted upon, and that's what the activists do. And the Free State Project, even if it's just, you know, leave it alone-ism, people who just want to be left alone. So I'm very, very happy to have gotten so many opportunities over the years to visit New Hampshire and get to know the people in the Free State Project.
Angela, you know, thinking of this from your perspective and my perspective, I mean, we have to, since we're not moving there, Hugo is, but the effect that it has had on the rest of the country, do you think that both the Free State Project and I think one other aspect of that is the Free Talk Live, the radio show, but we'll come back after the market.
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now.
Are you sick of government lackeys who say, "You didn't build that"? Are you tired of elitists like Barack Obama and Al Gore taking credit for the web while trying to take over the web? Are you disgusted by experts whose concept of the internet is that it's a series of tubes? Take back the free market of computing by encouraging software developers to adopt the BIPCOT NoGov license. The BIPCOT NoGov license allows any use or modification except by governments. Go to BIPCOT.org. That's Bravo, India, Papa, Charlie, Oscar, Tango.org.
Meow, meow. Meow, Freedom Fiends.
Oh, and we're coming back on the Freedom Fiends. And when we left for a moment there, I was about to ask you, Angela and Hugo, if do you think that the Free State Project has had a big effect or any effect on the liberty movement outside of New Hampshire? And I also wanted to throw in I think the radio and internet show Free Talk Live, which is on quite a few radio stations, I believe, and probably a lot more people listen over the internet. Between those two things, do you think that New Hampshire has become a bit of a hub, a new hub or main one, relative to the other things that used to hold the libertarian movement together, or a place where people look to resources, ideas, inspiration? I don't know. Any of that there that you can see? Angela?
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
I was thinking in terms of the things and the people that influenced the libertarian movement 20 and 30 years ago that are now either gone or have been eclipsed by these newer things.
Just the balance of power in the movement is now in the grassroots. Never again, or I mean, as ever wonderful as they were at their best, you know, in the Cato Institute and Mises Institute and these other things. I mean, they were great pre-Ron Paul era, but they don't make as much sense now. I mean, now it's back in the hands of people on the ground, and that's really where it should be. It was not necessarily the best of things to do to institutionalize libertarianism so early on in its development. So I think this is the Free State Project and the thing, the whole entity that is a Liberty Radio Network, yes, which carries all these shows, Free Talk Live, and it's sort of been a concurrent thing that's grown concurrently with the Free State Project, and certainly covers very carefully all the different activism and political things that go there. In fact, I'd say it's the first kind of libertarian media we've had since Liberty Magazine, where there's critical coverage of the libertarian movement, where libertarians actually look at things critically and analyze, and it's not just an anarchist cheerleading outfit having these different shows and media on LRN. But I mean, when you hear the show, if you listen to the network throughout the day, you hear ads still for all the top think tanks, a wide variety of libertarianism, lots of different sects of libertarianism represented on LRN. So I think that's an incredibly healthy and honorable project, and something that I certainly hope to see go on for decades. It's also, I think, from my point of view of my day job, I'd have to say maybe not Minnesota anymore, but places. I think New Hampshire might be the largest concentration of anti-war activists.
Well, that's all there's left, right? And when the liberals and conservatives, some of them are anti-war until their president, their candidate gets in power, and then I'm not saying they become pro-war, but it's kind of hard to criticize your own guy when he's doing the things that the government's always done. And
well, sure, one of the great things that would come out of electing a Republican president is that the Democrats could go back to being anti-war again.
Yeah, that's for really, sure, and that's why
it seems that way.
Yeah, libertarians have been consistently anti-war, the most of them. There's been a bit of a conservative reveal this past year, 2015. But at any rate, it's as in antiwar.com, it's the most important anti-war site out there, and it's a libertarian one. It's gotta be. There isn't any other way. So yeah, I do think I like the big tent that the Free State Project and the whole grassroots and New Hampshire and Free Talk Live movement has is a large stand in the act, in the sense that not on principles, but a large stand in the sense that you may get involved in whatever activity you think is best for advancing liberty. It's a different kind of big tent. What do you think?
Oh, you can come from a lot of different angles. Well, Angela, with your angle with antiwar.com, it's really interesting. I mean, the internet, I mean, most people have had it available for 15 and 20 years, and some even longer, I guess. But I didn't pay much attention to antiwar.com, which was kind of silly because I was anti-war. But for some reason, I had the perception that it was lefties, and I wasn't really interested in that. And then when I started looking into the libertarian movement, figuring out that that is actually what I was. I was delighted to find out that antiwar.com was more of a freedom-oriented effort and website, and embraced it completely. I even found out that a good buddy of mine that I grew up with was a contributor there, and I was surprised and happy when I found it out. I tell people they should go there, and if they are conservatives, I say I don't think you'll be offended if you have an inclination to small government. You'll find a lot of things you like, along with the idea that the empire's not doing us any good.
No, it's certainly not. And speaking of conservatives, today's American Conservative magazine, if you go online, Kelly Vlahos, who's a regular columnist for the American Conservative, wrote an amazing profile piece of 20 years of antiwar.com, which we celebrated last month, and the article appears in today's on today's website.
Congratulations.
And it's and I'm very fortunate to be a part of it, and it's a and we've gotten a lot of respect from people on the hard left for staying the course. We stay anti-war irrespective of who is in office. We don't make the politics over the principle. The principles of anti-war are what matter.
You don't care whose war it is.
Nope.
You in whose country, right?
Yeah, we know what country it is. No matter who's the president, I'm paying for it out of my wallet, too. And it probably doesn't make any difference to the guy that's on the other end of the bombs, either.
No one ever says, I wish a Democratic president would drone me.
No one cared which it was, right?
Right, exactly.
What an honor to be droned by, Barack Obama as opposed to George Bush. I could care less.
Well, that kind of makes me think of, you think about that's how people's brains work, is it's better to be, it's better when Barack Obama takes us to mass murder and invades countries and occupies them in all sorts of subtle and not so subtle ways. But that's what, the anti-war movement, we saw the real versus the fake. The fakers split off pretty quickly as soon as they realized Obama was going to be elected, and that was that. That was the last we saw of them.
Who was the congressman? I don't know if he's still in there or not. The congressman who kept wanting to bring back the draft, I think just to get people to oppose war again. Could that have been... Charlie Rangel, maybe? Was that who it was?
It could be. Charlie Rangel sometimes makes controversial propositions. I actually don't know if it was him or not. I should probably look that up right here.
It might have been him. I don't know why I was thinking Barney Frank, but I'm thinking Charles Rangel, and he may be out of office now. If he's from New York, I don't keep up with him real well, but I always thought that was interesting. When he would say that, because your first reaction, if you have any decency at all, is of course there should not be a draft. But then
you're right; it was Charles Rangel. It was him. He definitely did that. Wow. Okay. Yes, he wanted to bring back the draft. It's the draft is conscription. It's a rather dangerous and sad thing. You're basically kidnapping young people and sending them to go fight.
It's a form of slavery.
But Congressman Rangel figured, though, that if they brought back the draft, he could reawaken the movement of people of military age to be against the war again, because now they don't much care, because it's not going to influence them. Whereas when I went to college, the protests were everywhere, and it was only a few months before I went that the National Guard killed four students at Kent State in 1970, and it was still, just as very hot for a while after that, and the campuses were just full of people who were protesting all the time. And now you just, the draft ended, and I wouldn't bring back the draft. I don't think it's a good idea, but I get the idea.
Well, that's really evil.
And it probably would.
That's really evil, but that would be the kind of... that would be the kind of exactly the opposite to what Milton Friedman did when he recommended the government end the draft, because he figured out, you know, we can get all these protests will stop if we don't force people to go and just, you know, ask for volunteers and pay them money, and voluntary soldiers and give them a salary, and then, well, the outrage will be much less.
And that is that. Did he actually say that, or is that just sort of a cynical view of Milton Friedman?
Well, I would say probably that's my cynical view of him. But what I've read about it is that he did actually recommend it to. Was it Nixon who stopped the draft?
Well, it was. And Milton Friedman, I think, was on the committee along with who was the general that was a big guy in Vietnam War. I don't remember whatever the main general was at the time. You know, the general was completely against eliminating the draft, and his public stance was, I will not lead an army of mercenaries. And I believe Milton Friedman was supposed to have rejoined that and said, well, would you rather lead an army of slaves?
Well, that's a very practical and pragmatic view of the matter. What I looked it up, and it says here it was Friedman in the 1970s who sold the idea to then Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird, yeah, who first moved the U.S. away from a conscription force. So yeah, he did suggest the idea or sell the idea to the Secretary of Defense. So I think, well, yeah, that would be. He did all the right thing for the wrong reasons. Maybe,
well,
this guy,
you know,
was.
And that was probably. Maybe he was just selling. He knew he could sell a good idea by appealing to their baser instincts.
Yeah.
So he said, get rid of the draft and the protests will end. Yay.
We'll be back.
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
This show survives on donations from fiends like you. We put that money back into our show and Liberty Outreach and donate most our ad space to Liberty organizations that make a difference. We're also a teaching hospital, educating the next generation of Liberty Talkers on the skills needed to keep the radio flame of truth burning into the future. Put your money where your heart is and make a donation of any amount to the Freedom Fiends. Please go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post.
Meow, meow. No Friedmanites here in the Freedom Fiends. We're back. And Randy with Randy and Angela and me, Hugo, from Mexico City.
Present.
Yeah, here. So we were talking about, before the break, we were talking about Milton Friedman, and we didn't quite wrap that idea up, right?
I don't know about, we talked about Milton Friedman, and, you know, I just got for Christmas, somebody gave me his son's book, the third edition of The Machinery of Freedom, which is, you know, sort of the consequentialist libertarian anarchist opus. Boy, say that three times in a row, fast. But, and I'm looking forward to reading that. But we were talking about Milton Friedman and the anti-war movement, which was sort of killed when they got rid of the draft back in the 70s. And Angela, bring it up to date. You study this and talk about this a lot. I mean, does it make any difference at all what we do or who is elected, you know, when it comes to the war policies of the United States at this point?
No, the structures are all going to remain the same. You're still going to have all your military installments. It's not as if there's going to be any rollback on the wars. Listen to what the candidates are saying carefully, but also really understand that when their behavior is, what their behavior is going to be in office is already dictated by the nature of power. It's not like anyone's going to say, get into office and say, I want to repeal these executive powers. No one ever says that. That's just not the nature of people who seek power. So when Hillary Clinton's elected, and she does have a history of being a hawk. I mean, she's a hawk, and she, you know, may go out of her way to prove herself even more hawkish than the last person. Just like, you know, Barack Obama was a little bit more worse. It was a little bit worse than George Bush, and George Bush was worse than Bill Clinton. It just keeps going. The beast of power keeps growing and growing. Imperial power. It will keep endlessly growing until we run out of money, or until our currency drops, or until some kind of environmental catastrophe happens.
Do you think of it, that there would be any difference at all, say, between Hillary and Donald Trump?
No, I just, without getting too much into the theatricality of Donald Trump trying to push people's buttons, the fact is he's part of the establishment. He was at the Clintons' wedding, for crying out loud. You don't run in those circles without being part of that world. And he's having a good time, and there's particular monkey-wrenching reasons why he might be doing certain things, or he might be able trying to prove a point, who knows. But it's not as if he's actually going to do some of the kooky things. But a really important point, and a lot of people like Glenn Greenwald and Justin Raimondo and others want to remind you of this, is that the things that Donald Trump says that are outrageously racist and bigoted about various groups are also things that Hillary Clinton does in her actions. I mean, see how she behaved in Libya. That's how she sees people. I'm not talking about the way the Fox views the scandal. I mean, the fact that, you know, basically she unleashed a civil war that completely tore apart a otherwise functioning country until, you know, Haridisi. So, and if you read carefully, I mean, you can see that her skullduggery in Libya is far deeper than anyone Fox would be willing to deal with, because Fox only goes so far. It stays well within of what the bounds of, you know, populist right goofballness is allowed on television. So, no, there'll be no difference. It does not matter which any one of these jerks you elect. It will be the same.
The reason I ask was that I had noticed that at times Trump, you know, tries to be the most outrageous guy. Maybe it's when the other candidates have become so outrageous in their hawkishness, and they do that also. You get Chris Christie up there, and you know, we're going to have the no-fly zone and everything, and shoot down the Russian. And at that point, maybe when everybody else gets, you know, out Trumps Trump, maybe he goes the other way and says, "Oh, I was completely against the war in Iraq. We need to bring the boys home." And I mean, he has said things like that, and I just wondered if you thought that meant anything. Because, well, I'm afraid that we may end up getting the guy.
Well, he says those things to appeal to a certain kind of populist audience, because remember, all different kinds of people are anti-war. It's not just, you know, lefty commies and stinking hippies. Lots of people are anti-war, whether it's for religious reasons, whether they're kind of traditional conservatives where they want to mind their own darn business and they don't have any interest in paying any tax money for overseas adventures. So, you know, there are yokels who say, yeah, no to war too, and they should be respected.
Okay.
All right.
It makes a lot of sense. We'll be back for
Hugo,
hour two.
Angela. See you then. Worms.
Wow. Worms.
Hey, this is Squiscar Squiggles from Death Clocks. And you are listening to the Freedoms Fiends on the, you know, the radios. And I guess I says worms now, so there you go.
Tired of those old Freedom Fiends buttons? Well, the Freedom Fiends have new button designs.
As always, it's only $10 for 10 buttons, and you'll get these nifty designs. Buy sheep, for sheep, on sheep.
State speech is hate speech.
Two designs for Guns and Weed, the Road to Freedom.
Three designs for Fiend Phone.
Bipcot No Gov.
A Freedom Fiends worms button.
And ask me about my worms.
Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says buttons.
And now they're bigger buttons.
They used to be 1 1/4 inch, and now they're 1 3/4 inch. Dan, they're bigger buttons.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at lrn.fm. That's lrn.fm.
Meow, meow. Meow, meow, meow.
Estos son los Freedom Fiends, transmitiendo desde el cañón iónico de baja órbita del campo de reeducación libertario en la cima de la plaza financiera bestial en el satélite artificial Deep Air 2017 en la región de Alpha Centauri. Y es importante recordar que los Freedom Fiends están cubiertos por una licencia BIPCOT que permite que pueda cualquiera utilizar esto en lugar, a excepción de los gobiernos. So, did you get any of that, Randy and Angela?
Sí.
Yes.
Perfect. So, Angela, I bet you hear a lot of Spanish spoken there in California, or you're in a
yes.
non-Spanish speaking part.
No, it's here all the here Spanish, here Russian, here Armenian. Here a lot of languages here.
Is it hard to tell Armenian from Russian?
You start recognizing people's accents after a while.
Because I know an Armenian guy, but he always sounds Russian to me, so I guess I don't know the difference very well.
Yeah, it's pretty close to Little Armenia. Yeah, different concentration. So, yes, yeah, so here. And, yes, there's a lot of Spanish spoken in my neighborhood. It's a really great place, and I am very far away from the next person. So I have space
in the middle of the city. It's good to know.
Yes.
And you probably don't even have 20 million people in your whole city, right?
I think it's a small 8 million? Town.
Yeah, see.
Total in the LA area?
Oh, that's...
See, I think Hugo's city could like beat up just about any other city, right?
Yeah, just about any other. Outside of a few cities in China and India, yeah. Yeah, there's...
But that would be nice, so...
Well, no, there's no beating up other countries. Here, hopefully, yes. You know, it's a good thing about living in Mexico. There's not a lot of...
hopefully not.
Yeah, not a lot of war around. Just the inside, you know, the inside wars against drugs. And there's a lot of drug warriors here, too, you know, still.
When did Mexico last have a war?
It was, the 20th century was really a mess. So there were two...
You had a revolution then,
yeah,
didn't
the revolution. You? And then there was what could basically be talked about as a religious war. So, the Guerra Cristera, which was, yeah, it was a religious conflict. So, yeah, the last time was the 1920s. So, yeah, we've been without a war for almost a century.
But that was internal. Have you had any wars with any other countries?
With Spain.
Since you had one with the United States?
Yeah, the Mexican-American War. That's true. I was forgetting about that one. And, you know, we all libertarians tend to discourage using the word we or you in the plural sense. And, yeah, yes. That was the war where we fought against you.
Yes, that's almost 200 years ago, right?
Yeah, it was, I believe it was before the Civil War, I think, or just after.
Right,
Civil War.
And you had another war just ahead of that, didn't you, when you had the war of where Texas seceded from your union, if I remember right.
That's true. That's almost never taught as a war here in public school, for example. They don't talk about that much because, you know, we were the bad guys. And usually when you're the bad guy, you tend to forget that war existed or rephrase it in the sense that you are good. You're the good guy. So, yes, when
so
Texas...
You, and when I say you, forgive me for saying you, but just to the shorthand, Mexico was the bad guy in the Texas War for Independence.
Yeah.
But was Mexico the good guy or bad guy in the Mexican-U.S. War?
I don't think there was, and there was a good guy there, and this comes to something I've learned from from Ben Stone, the Bad Quaker, which we love here in this show. And I listened to a series.
Despite his name, is a good guy, right?
He's a great guy. He's just a bad Quaker because he approves. He approves of self-defense. So yeah, that makes him a bad Quaker. And I learned that there were no good guys in that war. And you know that the whole thing with that war is there were lots of people claiming ownership of things that weren't theirs, and territories and places where there was nobody living, at least no Americans or either Americans or Mexicans living there. So let's imagine Colorado in 1850. How many people lived there, or Wyoming or Montana, and still were territory claims there.
What, you know, I, one other thing I've always been curious about is that how is I'm not sure if I say his name right, your president or general Santa Anna, who I know fought in the Texas War and probably fought in the American-Mexican War. How is he seen in Mexican history?
He's seen in a very bad light. I don't know why, because he ruled the country for several different administrations. But he's seen several times. Yeah, several times. Like, I don't know, five times or something like that in the 19th century. But he's often reviled. But that's probably because they need to do that. They need to do that because they wanna. And I'm saying they here, the government, court historians, I would say, they tend to lump him together with when Mexico lost those territories. You know, people, the American government stole California and Texas, all those kind of things they attribute to Santa Anna. He betrayed Mexico. Those kind of silly, discourses.
So he's kind of more like a Nixon or... Nixon, despite, along with his other troubles, he's the one who ultimately lost Vietnam.
Yeah.
And so he didn't win, so he's not a hero.
Yeah, exactly.
And
that.
Neither did Santa Anna, right?
And yeah, totally. And you were talking before about the Texas-Mexican War, and that's usually here lumped together with the Mexican-American War. And, you know, people don't get taught in school or even... By historians, you know, by common mainstream books and speeches and so on, they don't get taught that those were two very different conflicts. One was a war of secession when Texas seceded from Mexico, and the other one was the whole other thing where Mexico lost, and I'm giving it air quotes now, California and some other territories in Arizona. Yeah.
Wasn't it kind of a continuation of the Texas independence war?
Yeah, it was.
Because it started over, they were still disputing over the boundary of Texas and Mexico, and didn't that cause the United States to get involved? Because of fighting about that boundary,
that is correct.
The Texas boundary,
yes, but they don't make it.
Kind of, it was.
Yeah,
I mean, you could put the two wars together. Of course, you could put World War One and World War Two together also, because one of them followed the other like night after day, right?
Sure. Yes. Yeah.
At least I think so.
I agree with you completely. But the point is, in one word, really, the villains. Because they just wanted to secede, and that there was no superpower involved. You know, it's when people look at the relative sizes and wealths of Mexico and in America right now, they would say, you know, it's a superpower against a smaller country. That was not the case in the 19th century. So that way, if you lump it together, if you lump the Texas secession together with the Mexican-American War, you can still be as Mexico. You can still be the victim and not the bad guy.
Oh, you mean the victim of the big,
the big
bad United States?
That's how it's seen here. Of course, that's not the way I see it. But you know, I'm an anarchist in Mexico, so the same way.
And I wanted to, you being from Mexico and everything. Recently, congratulations on your government recapturing wasn't El Chapo?
That
the fellow?
Yeah, it's a big drug dealer. It doesn't affect me.
I bet it's a relief for you to have him off the streets, right?
It doesn't affect me one way or the other. So, yeah, I think that's what you gotta go through in life, right? You know, it's interesting, you know, to know the drama, but it doesn't affect me either way.
When I saw that the guy escaped by digging a tunnel under his cell, and then he had kind of a motorcycle on a railroad to get away, I thought, that's just precious. And you know, you had to love that. I mean, I don't know what the guy ever did. I mean, maybe he was a bad guy or not, but I thought that's a story that, well, actually, to be honest, the reason that I liked it is I thought that the government probably was really, didn't they have egg on their face about that?
Well,
the government, were they embarrassed?
When the government loses face, I'm always satisfied on at least on one level. Yeah, sure. He's no doubt a bad guy, but not because he deals with drugs, but because he kills people and he kills his competition. I would say that. I mean, you know, selling drugs to willing buyers should not be illegal. But he does also.
I bet he wouldn't be killing anybody if it was legal.
Well, I would think that guy would probably, he's a psychopath, and he could probably be into another different business that's much less profitable. And that would be a good thing if he were into, he's probably gonna do crimes all his life, but he could move into, you know, crimes where he doesn't affect so many people, he doesn't get so much money, and that sort of things. For that, but yeah, the silver lining is the government loses face.
So you're saying that if they made drugs illegal, he would probably gravitate. He'd find something that was
kidnapping,
illegal.
Kidnapping, or I don't know, prostitution. If it were,
is there a
still
lot of
illegal
money in kidnapping?
well, they say there is here, but
maybe.
Yeah, maybe in Mexico.
It's not a big money trade here, but maybe you can get away with it better. I don't know, down there. But I tend to think of, you know, whenever you have a drug dealer, no matter how bad they are, you're thinking of drugs were legalized. These drug dealers would no more be, you know, killing each other at the convenience store than the Pepsi and the Coke drivers are shooting it out at the grocery store parking lot.
Exactly. Just, you know, you can compare.
It wouldn't happen.
You can compare with legal drugs. You know, the Pfizer and the Merck are not fighting over turf today.
No.
Right?
Pharmacists are mostly peaceful, I think.
Yeah. Those are drugs, but they're legal.
Yes.
Say whoops to that. We'll be back from the market in a minute.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts.
When you shop online, please do it through the Freedom Fiends Amazon link over on the right side of freedomfiends.com. It won't cost you any extra, and the fiends will get a little taste from Amazon, and Amazon will save you the danger of drive-by stabbings at your local mall. Amazon sells pretty much everything you can buy on this earth, except for guns and weed. But they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed: The Road to Freedom. So get that for your gun-hating stoner brother or neocon gun nut dad. They'll thank you for it. That's freedomfiends.com. Freedom, Foxtrot, Echo, Echo, November, Sierra.com.
Ooh, meow, meow.
Meow, meow. And we're back, and it's the Freedom Fiends. This is Hugo here, and with me is Randy and Angela. And we were talking about Mexico before we went to the market. And we're talking about Chapo and so many things. But, you know, being here in Mexico, sometimes news and the things that happen out in the U.S. are not perceived in the same way. And recently there's been a couple of things happening in Oregon. And I don't know, it's sometimes I think it's a libertarian thing. Sometimes I think that these people are loons. How did the whole thing start? Do you know what's that all about? Randy, maybe?
Are you asking me?
Yeah, maybe.
You know, one thing, well, I'll tell you, as to what the people, we're talking about the occupying the federal land or building or something in Oregon, and I don't really know about what's all behind that, but the thing that was behind that even further, or I guess the match that started this thing and got so many people riled up, was these two fellas that were relations to the guy that was in the standoff, and a lot of people were upset that these two guys got convicted of arson, basically for setting some fires on their own land, I don't know, to clear brush or to set a a fire break where there's other fires and you want to protect your property. And I think maybe one of them might have gotten a little out of control and went onto some federal land and got put out. Wasn't a real big thing, but they were tried, were convicted of arson or some offense just like that, which had minimum punishments of 5 years in prison for this piddly thing that would have been a misdemeanor anywhere else on earth, I would think, if it should have even been that. And after they were convicted, the judge said, this is completely unconscionable. I cannot sentence these men to 5 years in prison, federal prison. And when you get 5 years in federal prison, there's no parole. You serve the five or just almost all of it. And there's no way out. And the judge refused to do it and sentenced them to a much shorter sentence, like 6 months for one of them, I don't know, a year for the other. I'm not sure. But it was a short period of time. They served their, short period of time, and the government appealed. And the government actually said the law was on their side. When I say the government, I mean the prosecutors, the U.S. attorneys that were handling the case, and said, you cannot sentence anyone who gets convicted of a five-year minimum sentence to anything less than 5 years. I mean, yeah, it's brutal. It's cruel. I don't know how you live with yourself, but yeah, 5 years is 5 years, and the Court of Appeals agreed with that and said, no, these men have to go back to prison and serve their 5 years. And that was coming up, was pending for them to go back into prison, and they agreed to go back, and everybody else is really up in arms over what is obviously to just about anybody a gross injustice. And that seemed to be a precipitating event that got people so upset and up in arms that this standoff thing began. And that's really about, you know, all that I know about the silly thing, as to the causes behind it. But what exactly the folks in the standoff wanted to accomplish, I don't know.
What do you do? What do you do as a libertarian in the face of injustice, even so that you're not surprised by it, which is a difference if you're really into the Constitution and the rule of law and respect such things, or the rulings of judges, and sometimes these things happen, and you get surprised, which doesn't happen with us. I'm pretty sure with you, Randy, and with Angela, you don't get surprised by injustice being committed by government courts, do you?
No, yeah. It is kind of odd that you have there were relations to some of these same folks. Was it the Cliven Bundy? Was that the fellow down in the Southwest last year?
Bundy Ranch.
The Bundy Ranch had the standoff, and here they are. They're fighting with the federal government, who in this case is their blood-sucking enemy, and they're running around waving American flags. And it's like, well, we still have faith. We can take this country back, and the Constitution will save us if only we can go back. And they haven't figured out yet that it has failed. And maybe they just need to have their heads beaten in longer. I hope not.
I hope not.
We'll be back.
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
Are you sick of peaceful people being locked away for victimless crimes? Instead of trying to get out of jury duty, consider taking it so you can do the right thing. A single juror with a conscience can send someone home to their family instead of to a jail cell. If there's no victim, how can there be a crime? And if the judge or prosecutor are keeping you in the dark, what are they trying to hide? You can vote your conscience instead of being a pawn of the state. For more information, Google jury nullification or check out the Fully Informed Jury Association at fija.org.
And the fiends are back with Hugo, Randy, and Angela. And I asked before the break, I asked, what's a libertarian to do when faced with such injustice as we talked before with about the things in Oregon, and not just in Oregon, anywhere where you see injustice being committed by the state. What do you do, and what's wrong with what these people have done? I'm not sure. Angela, you have any views on that?
I'll just try to summarize all the different ways on social networking people can be really irritating about this. They can complain about how this particular group of occupiers has very silly constitutionalist beliefs that are, you know, that are completely dated and you know, statist and whatnot, or that they're racist or sexist or homophobic, whatever. The point is, these people are, when you're saying that you want. And when I'm talking about this, I'm talking maybe liberal activists on Twitter, let's say, which there's a lot of them, or progressives, saying that the state should, that injustice and brutality should be distributed evenly. So, you know, because the argument is that if they were black, this would have ended already pretty bloodily. Mind you, though, this is not going to end well for these ranchers, we'll call them ranchers. It's not going to end well for them. The best scenario is that, you know, they're not, that they don't lose their lives immediately, and that they, you know, they're going to go to prison, and all the people involved are going to lose, you know, their land, their livelihoods. They're going to have nothing but legal fees. It's going to be a disaster from here on out for them. They're not getting off with anything. But you're asking to unleash the biggest, most powerful, brutal empire in human history against a bunch of guys, you know, who was a Jim Babb on an earlier edition of Freedom Fed, says are essentially occupying a picnic table. Now, what is wrong with people to think this way, that this could possibly be a rational solution? I mean, whenever your answer to something is more violence, you probably need to check your premise in the first place. And I will never understand for the life of me, no matter what I do with my life or how I think about things or all the years I've lived, how it is that there are rational people on the planet who will side with the pigs over the people, which is what people are doing here in this case.
I can't disagree at all, and I have a knee-jerk built-in reaction that when anyone is going up against the federal government, I mean, unless they're some sort of killer themselves, I'm on this little guy's side. And of course, as you pointed out, it wouldn't matter who it was on the other side, they're going to be the little guy, because they're faced with an empire that was bigger than Rome. There's nothing that on earth that has ever been, you know, in 4 billion years to the present that could possibly stand up to them. And so I always, you know, I guess I admire any activism that I see that is standing up to the government. But then the next moment, you know, I sometimes just want to cry, because I know how badly, you know, it can end. And maybe this is very unwise, very imprudent. You know, you might look at it and go, this is not the picnic table that I want to die on. And, you know, that could very well be true. I mean, there's these cases, there's little cases. You see the videos from up in Keene, New Hampshire, when the Free Staters love to go in and spar with that judge in that city court there, and they go in with all kinds of arguments and question the judge, and I watch it, and I'm rooting for those guys, but I'm just shaking my head knowing this isn't going to end well for you. And it doesn't, you know, and they end up getting their fines and jailed, you know, and this is much more serious.
Time is very limited, and also our resources. So I don't know, as much as I like nagging the state, I don't think you know, and I think most of the fiends are with me. As the positions I've heard from them, it would be very unwise to go down in a blaze of glory because, you know, you might be remembered in some you know, some book, some years from now. I'd rather be stay alive and do my activism some other way. I don't know. Would you do the same? I think we are because we're communicating right now instead of, you know, planting some kind of doing some kind of standoff somewhere.
I think that's it's a good point. You ask, you know, what would we do? And I'm sitting here thinking, what would I do? And then you said it. You said, well, actually, it's what you are doing. You know, and if I look around, you know, in my town, I look around. There's so few libertarians or voluntarists or anarcho-capitalists in my town, and the few, so many that consider themselves libertarians, their only thing they're interested in is, you know, some single issue here, maybe a legalized pot or something. And I say, I'm totally with you on that and everything, but what about the key issues here? Not just the, you know, if all you want to do is legalize the one vice that you engage in, you know, that's really not going to make you a libertarian. You need to be in favor of every aggression. I mean, against every aggression by the state. And so it's this people that I can relate to are so thin on the ground here. If there weren't the internet, I don't know where I would find anyone else that I could even talk to, let alone have any effect. And, you know, you talk to people one at a time and your friends and you can have some effect, but sometimes you feel like you're beating your head against a wall. And it's really, really great to be able to have some outlet where you can, you know, reach more people and, heck, even just talk about it. You sit there with it in your own little mind and you go, well, we're not getting anywhere here. I'm not doing anything at all. What do you think, Angela?
Well, yeah, I don't do much activism. My activism days have been long behind me. I just try to observe what people do so I can look at trends. And also, I just have a general commitment to complete radical indifference to how people conduct their lives as long as it's peaceful. Any activism, I'm not, you know, I don't sit there and tell people how to do their activism. I just don't. It's just the way I feel as an anarchist, where it's just not my place. I adhere to kind of a rather strict, thin libertarianism, where it's mere liberty that I'm interested in, and I don't try to impose any cultural preferences, and I don't particularly try to force people into any one set of tactics or confuse tactics and strategies, which libertarians are very good at doing. You know, with an ideology, for example. I mean, if you're using states' rights to get gay marriage or legalized marijuana, I mean, there's goods in that. They're immediate. That's an immediate good for immediate relief. Is it freedom in the long run? No. But, you know, if you're sick, you need pot. You know, that's, you know, you're worth to take that incrementalist change, even though it's certainly not as smart as just decriminalizing all drugs. You know, people do what they need to do to put their own self-interest first, and I ultimately think that's a healthy thing. I think those incentives and those drives really could create a free society if there were, you know, not the monopoly on power that is the state.
This it's very interesting.
With that.
Yeah, what you just said is it's very interesting. I never thought of it the way you're just saying it. People tend to confuse the tactics with sometimes even the principles, right? Such as what you just said about states' rights.
Yeah, I mean, like, people get upset, oh, states' rights, we'll associate with it slavery, whatever. Look, you're trying to get, until Obergefell, I'm going to pronounce that wrong, until finally decriminalization. I live in West Hollywood, I'm an out, and I don't want to get into all that, but, you know, I'm not straight. So, before, you know, when to get gay marriage, I was perfectly willing to say, let's talk about states' rights or local rights. I have no interest in places where there's concentrations of religious conservatives and people doing things a certain way to tell them how to live. I just don't want people coming here to West Hollywood and saying we can't have gay marriage or we can't have our pride parades or how we're going to do things to be more inclusive for trans people and their rights and here in West Hollywood. I'm not interested in going to someplace else and demanding. And I'm not interested in telling anyone else how to live. It goes back to the great Karl Hess, who is one of the most important philosophers and thinkers and activists of modern libertarianism, where freedom doesn't tell you how to live, just simply that, it doesn't tell you how to live, just simply that you can, or libertarianism says. I'm sure I screwed that up, but I think you understand the point. That's why we were talking about the Free State Project earlier. Why it's so successful is that it's some kind of, is it Mao? Is it let a thousand flowers bloom? Whatever communist said that. But let all the different kinds of activism flourish and let people make their own decisions on what they want to do for activism or not do activism at all. I mean, one of the things about libertarianism, and this is how I live my life in this part of my life, is that I express my libertarianism not through activism, but wanting to be left alone and letting.
I think we lost her. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did we lose?
Just a little bit. Yeah, we just lost her a little bit.
And one person that she just mentioned that I almost never hear anything about. And are you familiar? She mentioned.
Karl Hess.
Did she say the great Karl Hess?
She did.
Are you familiar with Karl Hess?
I am, and he's most famous for writing speeches for Barry Goldwater.
And I just love that guy. I really do.
I do. And some libertarians consider him some kind of leftist. And
he was a lot of inspiration toward the left libertarian side, and I'm not sure what I might have disagreed with him on. But so many of his the way that he approached problems, and he had so many good ideas. Reading his article from 1970, The Death of Politics. I mean, Google it on the internet if you haven't read it. It's so good. And then if you wonder what the guy is like, go to YouTube and type in Karl Hess, and just listen to him talk about the things that are important to him in that. He's just a wonderful character. Many, many really good impulses and ideas. He had a lot of changes that he went through in his life, and he's extremely conservative Republican. Back in 64, like you said, he was the main speech writer for Barry Goldwater. He was the one who wrote the line, I can't even remember the line now, but about extremism, and then he totally changed it and became a complete anarchist. Check out Karl Hess.
Kudos for him.
Amazing character.
Worms.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends. And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
For some reason in this country, and in a bunch of Western world, it's okay to just judge.
Hey, this is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends radio show. Computer programmer Derek Slopey and I have created Fiend Phone. I'm using Fiend Phone right now to talk with and record one of my co-hosts in real time. Take it, Davi.
Hey, this is Davi Barker, and I'm 1,000 miles away from Michael, but we sound like we're in the same room.
We sure do, Davi. So, Davi, please tell the nice people more about Fiend Phone.
Fiend Phone is free, no-gov software that opens up a global world of possibilities for collaborative, high-quality, remote voice media production, and I'm digging it.
People can try Fiend Phone right now at fiendphone.com, but we're also raising money to vastly improve Fiend Phone and vastly improve independent talk media worldwide.
So go to fiendphone.com to help out. Who will build the audio roads? We will, with your help.
That's fiendphone.com, FEENPHONE.com. Foxtrot, Echo, November, phone.com.
Fiend Phone, I never knew remote audio could be this good.
Meow, meow. That's the Wumpus Cat. Is that the Wumpus Cat? I think it is. Randy and me, Hugo, coming back with the Freedom Fiends for our last segment. And Randy, I have your quote right here. It's by Karl Hess,
and it says,
I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice, and let me remind you that also moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue. That's a famous quote.
And that was Barry Goldwater's most famous speech line. And it was written by Carl Hess. That was
when he accepted the Republican nomination in 1964. In San Francisco, of all places.
Just before he got his clock cleaned at the polls by Lyndon Johnson. And it was, I guess, sometime, you know, during the 60s, Carl Hess pretty much moved away from that conservative Republican view into a liberty standpoint. And I guess no one has a better view of the corruption of government than someone that is, you know, close inside it. And he moved to the point where he just saw the state as being essentially an evil thing, and wrote much about it. And he ended up, I think he died in the early 90s, maybe around 1991 or two or so. I guess he had a heart transplant, and then didn't make it after that. He still died a relatively young man. I mean, he wasn't young, but he didn't get to be old, sure.
By our standards of today.
Yes.
Before 70 or something.
That's right.
Yeah.
But like I said, to see him talk and the interviews that he gave and that, he's just a real delightful character. I listened to his, I read his biography. Sorry, I can't think of the name of it now, but just reading, he was such an appealing character, you know, both in his writings and on his you see his interviews and I'm sure that someone could pick apart some of his libertarian views here and there that might not fit exactly with current notions, but I can't help it. I really like the guy.
I really like him too. And
he's gone.
Yeah, well, sorry he's gone. But you know, you just said something that I found very interesting, is that he over the years he came to recognize the state as that huge beast that it is. And I think that would happen to anybody if we through our experiences, even in government or our daily dealings with government, and you know, just keeping our eyes open, we would recognize that the state is the great enemy of mankind, I would say, or humankind, however you want to say it.
Well, did you come to that easily?
Well, no, not at all. It took me years and years, but you know, sometimes, I don't know, corruption happens a lot here in Mexico, as you probably are aware. And I would say, for example, try to win a contract for supplying the government. This was, I don't know, probably 16 years ago, for selling them some kind of chairs for a school or something, when the commissar or the government worker would come in and ask openly for a 10% of that. Everybody in Mexico knows these things are happening,
and yet they don't. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, bribe.
A bribe.
It's, yeah, just okay. a commission, they would say, or a tithe. I don't know how to say it in English, but 10%. And the thing is, you know, people here know it exists. People here know it happens, that the government cannot possibly work efficiently, and the people are people in government. Most of them are really dishonest in many ways, but they don't connect the dots and come to the conclusion that government itself, the idea that somebody, a group of people in society should have the ability to threaten other people with jail or fines, to have them be controlled, you know, that they don't connect those dots.
Yes, although sometimes I think I would rather have to pay some minor bribes than have my front door broken down, my house searched, my dog shot.
Totally.
But I guess every state has its own vices.
That's even worse. Yeah, but you know, just keep your eyes open and see the state as it is. I would say that.
Hey, Hugo, it's been great. And Angela
thanks.
Had to go just a bit earlier,
yeah.
But loved having her on the Freedom Fiends tonight. And with you, Hugo, I hope you'll have me back sometime.
All good. Live free, worms.
Hey, Hugo, and you have a good afternoon. Worms.